Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
On each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 60, Getting Accessibility Right.
We are joined by the illustrious Steve Saylor, media editor at Can I Play That, accessibility consultant, content creator, and fabulous host. Steve is here to chat with us about accessibility and the new consoles. Steve, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to join us. This is going to be such a great conversation. Mike and I have been so excited about the way that we've been approaching the whole, you know, console launches and everything like that, because we want to do something different. We didn't want to just be about the technology or just about the games. We want to talk about the industry impact and what's going to be important in the near future and heading towards, you know, the rest of this console life cycle.
Yeah, I've been so excited for this conversation since we started mapping out like how we were going to do a virtual economy launch coverage thing. So this was something, as we sat down and we talked, that we knew we wanted to do, because accessibility is so important. And mm-hmm. we couldn't think of anybody better to have this conversation with than you. So we're so grateful for you taking the time.
Aw, thanks. Oh, you guys make a guy feel welcome. This is awesome.
That's the point, right? That's the point. That's how you know that we're good at our jobs as journalists. So, speaking of our jobs as journalists, this is a question that has been a staple of mine through every conversation that I've ever had as a journalist. I love origin stories. And anytime that we have someone on the show, we'd like to get a better idea of, you know, where they came from and why they're in gaming. So what I want from you, what we want from you, is tell us the when and the how you got your start in gaming and why you started working in accessibility, both as a critic and a consultant.
Well, my story is kind of multi-decades long, but I'll try to condense it in a sense. So I was born in... No, I'm kidding.
Do it. Let's listen to it. You're a fellow Canadian. Let's talk about all the Canadian things. Let's turn this into a Canada Standcast.
Sure. Okay. Hell yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. I was born just about 10 minutes outside Niagara Falls on the Canadian side.
Of course.
And so
the good
I always...
side, you mean, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
It is the prettier side.
It is, to be honest. And it's the more fun side. I'm not going to lie. but I always used to say, like, even growing up, it's sort of like when everyone's sort of like, oh, Niagara Falls, that must be so cool. I'm like, yeah, you know, been there, done that, got the multiple T-shirts. So it was but it was still cool to, like, obviously to, like, live in that area and growing up there. So when I was a kid, jumping into the actual, like, getting into video games, I grew up in the 80s, so my very first console was the original Nintendo Entertainment System. Yes. And I remember my mom took my brother and I, are roughly about a year and a half apart, and we went to this local video store called Jumbo Video, and this is when you
how Jumbo were their videos.
Elephant sized, because the elephant was the logo. Yeah, so but one other thing I loved about it, actually, was like when you walk in, they give you you can actually have free popcorn. Like they have like a popcorn machine right beside the door. What? That like you can be able to like pour like little bags of popcorn, and it was like movie theater sized popcorn. I like movie theater popcorn. Like you could Like it was probably, I would still to this day say it's like probably one of the best popcorn I've ever tasted.
It had
the right amount of salt, the right amount of butter. It was every single time.
That's,
I don't know what
dream.
It was. Oh God. Yeah.
That's the dream right there.
Hey, remember exactly. Movie theaters?
No.
Oh, yeah.
It was about a decade ago that we went to a movie.
Wow.
Not really. I mean, like, it was probably like last December.
No, it was the last movie we saw was for my birthday. We saw Birds of Prey.
Oh, that's true. We did go see Birds of Prey. So it was
February. That's probably my last movie I saw in theaters too, was Birds of Prey.
You know, that's not a bad one.
That's a good one to end on.
Yeah? Yeah.
Quite frankly.
As a series finale of movie theaters. I mean, that's not a bad movie to go on. Yeah.
That's okay. There's a lot of shows ending this year. America, for instance.
Oh, right. No.
Yes.
it had a good run, but the writers No.
See, what we're getting is that at least it's a series finale of America, but then you get like the now you're rebooting. So you're rebooting America at this point. So it's like America, I don't know. What's the teen way of being able to
America 2 Electric Boogaloo.
There you go. Perfect.
Nailed it. Got it too.
Exactly.
America Reborn.
Yeah. That's a really bad idea, and I don't like it. I like Electric Boogaloo better.
No. It's like the U.S. of A. Like that's like they would always kind of like they would always kind of like tweak the wording a little bit to kind of make it seem like hip.
Oh, the U.S. of A. Oh God, this is turning into a Canada Stan cast, and I'm here for it. Yes. I love it.
United States, the dark years.
Oh God.
No. Oh, guys. No. Guys, we're getting off track here. We're getting off track.
The United States, the electoral college years.
Oh. It's funny because it's sad.
I would too like to disband the Galactic Senate.
I love this already. Anyway, yes. So Jumbo Video. Yes.
Jumbo Video.
Yeah. So my mom, she went in there and she was going to buy a gift for my dad for Father's Day. And she saw a thing that basically was like a Nintendo, like it was like a video game thing. And she didn't really know 100% what it was. But she knew like kind of like my dad, like in the 70s, he did play a little bit of like the Atari and kind of like just like Pong, I think was probably a game that he liked. And it was simple for him to be able to play because it was a joystick and one button. And so my mom thought, yeah, you know what? I'll get that, and that'll be a gift for him. But I think she secretly meant that gift was going to be for my brother and I, that we were going to play it more. So we got it, and we actually didn't even realize that the system came with a game. So my mom had to look for a game to buy, and she found the Three Stooges NES game.
Oh, that game wasn't bad though.
It was good. It was simple and it like had a bunch of mini games, but it was still fun to play.
Like throwing the pies, like you got, because the goal of the game is to save the orphanage.
Exactly. Yep. And you had to. I think it was like $10,000 you had to be able to get over the course of the game, and you never seem to get it. Like it's very rare that I think I've ever actually like beat the game. But it was so much fun. But when we got it, we brought it home, and then my dad opened up for Father's Day and we saw that, oh, there's actually another game inside, and it had Super Mario and Duck Hunt. And I remember we played it, and it was funny that my mom actually fell in love with Mario, like to the point where she actually beat Mario before my brother and I did.
Wow. And
I still say to this day, I think my mom totally would have been a gamer if she didn't find the NES version of Monopoly, because that's only game she's ever played since. Yeah, she got addicted real quick to that one. Yeah, to the point where she is so addicted to Monopoly that whenever you play her, it like she always wins. But in the rare occasion that you do beat her, she will refuse to believe that that is the case. She was like, nope, didn't happen. Like it's basically the American election. Like she totally would be like, nope.
I didn't want to insult your mom by comparing it to this shit show. But
I'll totally go there. I mean, yeah, no, my mom is like ruthless. She should be like, nope, okay, no. She to this like even when I tell her, it's like, hey, remember when I beat you in Monopoly? She's like, nah, I don't remember that at all. I'm like, oh, okay, thanks, mom. I don't think my parents will probably listen to this, but we're getting my dad a Switch for Christmas this year.
Oh, nice.
The whole family. And so my mom's really excited to be able to jump in and play video games again. So she's really excited about that. When I used to play games, the problem was I used to think that I just sucked at them. I knew I was blind since birth. Where I have like a condition that's called nystagmus. And essentially what that means is that it's an involuntary eye movement where my eyes move back and forth and I can't control it. And that kind of makes my visual acuity 20/200. So when I'm looking at something that's 20 feet away, it will look like it's 200 feet away. And that's with my glasses on. So with my glasses off, it's more like 20/1700, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I always had to sit close to the TV in order to be able to see anything. And when I tried to play video games, I used to like think that I just sucked at them for whatever reason. I didn't really even think that my eyes were kind of the thing that was getting in the way, or my disability was getting in the way. I didn't even think like the term disability even entered my lexicon until much later in life. So I was kind of always felt like I was a casual gamer pretty much my entire life. It was something I enjoyed doing, but whenever I try to be able to play a game and I'm just like, I just can't play it, or I just suck at it. I just will stop and not play it again. And I've sold, I've returned or traded in so many games in my lifetime that, I probably could have got rich off of it, because I've just tried so many different things and it just never seemed to work out. Including to the point where, up into like, this is years and later, I, essentially my, like, I'd say probably 2013, somewhere around there, like in between 2010 and 2015, essentially, I had sold all my consoles.
Really?
Yeah. I just wasn't playing them anymore, because it was I just felt like that there were games that I just couldn't play, or I just sucked at them. And so I kind of felt like, and I was kind of moving into a different direction. I essentially got really interested in radio. It was something I liked as a kid, because I loved sort of the old school like radio dramas. So I went into radio as something that as a career, and I was doing that for the past like 10, 15 years of my life. And in 2015, I was trying to kind of figure out something that I could be able to do on my own, because I've been creating content for like 15 years at that point. So I started creating content in 2005. Sorry, I'm jumping around a lot. Wow, I apologize. I started creating content around like 2005, but it wasn't until like 2015 that I kind of thought about creating anything around gaming. I'd done some like geeky sort of podcasts, but I always kind of left the gaming to my other co-hosts essentially. In 2015, I was with my friends, and I had told them, it's like I've been telling them for years that I sucked at video games, and I thought that, you know what, maybe what if I start like a YouTube channel, because Let's Plays was still pretty huge, like when you have like Markiplier and Jacksepticeye kind of starting around that time or becoming popular in that time. I thought, okay, yeah, this might be something fun. And I thought that my niche could be, well, I'm blind, and I'll just call myself Blind Gamer in that sense. And I wanted, like, I was like, okay, I'm going to create these episodes, and I'm going to basically, I told my friends for years I sucked at games. Now here's proof. And yeah, that's exactly what it was.
I respect that.
Yeah. So I figured, you know what? I can make fun of myself. I was at a point like in my life, I was like, I can make fun of myself. I can make fun of the fact that I'm blind. Like, it's fine. Like, I'm totally cool with that. So it's sort of like a comedic, humorous, entertaining way to sort of make people at least feel okay about the fact that it's like, I didn't want my channel to sort of be like, oh, the struggle is real with my disability and that kind of thing. It was just sort of like, hey, I'm having fun playing video games, even if I suck at them. And I started doing it, and I literally had, like, because I said that I had no consoles at that point, I had a friend of mine who ran a gaming magazine in Toronto, and he said, well, you know what, I have all the consoles and all the recording equipment, why don't you come to the office and you can record however many episodes that you want. And so for the very first few episodes of Blind Gamer was actually at those at that office. Comics and Gaming Magazine was the was the one that that I got to help with. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I'm at today.
They're really good people. They're exactly. Really, really good people there. I love that crew. I worked with them for a little while when I was freelancing, and nothing but good things to say about that crew. Just so kind.
Yeah, Brendan Fry was the one who really helped me and was like, hey, yeah, anytime, just come on over. As long as I'm there and we can be able to record stuff, then you're totally fine. So, big shout out to him. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. And so I started the YouTube channel. Essentially, I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this entertaining. And then I started kind of hearing about accessibility as something that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so it's gaming for with people with disabilities. I was like, okay, I started hearing about like able gamers, and I started hearing about sort of developers kind of adding accessibility in games, but I didn't really know much of it until I got invited to an Ubisoft UX summit that was happening in Toronto in 2017. And I didn't know at the time, I thought that I was there as sort of like the YouTuber, the gamer in a room full of developers. I thought like that was kind of like I was in a way the token gamer that was brought in for all this stuff. And I didn't realize actually the day that I showed up that apparently that day was focused solely on accessibility. And I was hearing like talks from people from Naughty Dog, from Bungie, from Microsoft, from all across the industry, just talking about accessibility and wanting to be able to improve it in games. And I was on a panel. That's how I was brought in. I was to speak with a panel with some people from Ubisoft, Microsoft, and Naughty Dog as well. And I remember I was sitting on stage and I had an epiphany, like literally in the middle of this talk. I had thought, well, okay, I sucked at video games, or I kept telling myself I sucked at video games, but in reality it was that games sucked for me. Mm. And it was at that moment that I realized, oh, okay, accessibility is where I need to focus it on. And so I've been basically working on that ever since. That's a very long-winded way to be able to tell that story, but I apologize.
No, I honestly, it's important, and the fact that Manda has brought this into the way we talk to guests on the show is important, because I think if you don't have the context for where somebody has been and the things that they've done in their life, then you're missing a piece of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it is why we continue to start every conversation with the origin story. But I want to focus on kind of fast forward to today. We have entered this brand new generation for consoles. The Switch is still doing really, really well.
It's still eating everyone's lunch.
Yep, and it's probably gonna, you know, if you look at units sold for this holiday, it's probably going to come out on top simply because of constrained supply. But mm-hmm. of course we have new Xbox consoles, we have new PlayStation. And just want to ask you, what are the things that you are most excited about, whether that's through the accessibility lens or in general?
In general, actually, I'm really excited to be able to kind of see games really taking like the really creating essentially the games that have like take advantage of the power of these systems, because they're pretty beefy boys in size and in specs. So I mean, they're pretty much like it, I mean, you pretty much have like we pretty have it. It's like they're equivalent to like today's PCs. Like they're just fancy looking boutique PCs at this point. but what I like about them is that it's sort of the versatility and sort of the possibility for the future of gaming, in that we like what I like about this is like new generation, sort of like we don't know where this generation is going to take us. And that's the excitement part for me. In regards to accessibility, what I like is that at least accessibility is part of the cornerstone now of this current generation. Because before, when the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One launched, there was no accessibility built in. That actually came into the operating system essentially like midway through that cycle. So the fact that we're now getting new consoles with accessibility built in, that is something that I'm very fascinated about. And if you want, we can kind of go into the specifics of sort of like what accessibility for each console.
I think we should, because I think that I think I know some of the things you're talking about, but I know that some of our listeners might not be as familiar with. So pointing out those specific features that have been added along the way last generation that have kind of made their way as foundational for this generation is important.
Sure. I'll start out like with PlayStation. So on the PS5, pretty much the majority of all of the accessibility settings that was in the PlayStation 4 is on the PlayStation 5, with some improvements and some things missing. They're actually one of the main accessibility options that I loved in the PlayStation 4 was the zoom option, where essentially you can be able to push and hold the PlayStation button, and I believe it was square or circle, and you could basically it'll zoom into the or magnify the screen, and you can use the thumbsticks to be able to move around so that you can be able to see the text a little bit clearer. And that's kind of where it was designed. It was designed for accessibility, but it was just, I don't think they kind of sort of thought, oh, people with blind or low vision will use this more than just sort of reading the text. But it worked within the games. Like you can be able to zoom in, and it will zoom into the games as well. Unfortunately, it's not in the PlayStation 5. I don't know why that is. I did reach out to PlayStation to find out, and all they said was that Zoom was not launching with the PlayStation 5 at this time. So I don't know if that means they're going to be launching it in the future, or there was just an issue with the design. I have a feeling that because you can't long press the PlayStation button on the DualSense controller anymore, that may have sort of been one of the reasons, because you had to push that, like, well, do a long press on that PlayStation button. But the majority of stuff is there. And the stuff that they added actually was really great. The screen reader has been vastly improved. It used to be that the screen reader text-to-speech that was on the PlayStation 4 was only in North America, and it was only in English. So anyone who had a PlayStation across the world couldn't use it. And so now with the PlayStation 5, the screen reader is not only available globally, but it's available, I think, in 24 languages. It is throughout the entire operating system. Every bit of text is readable, and you can be able to adjust the speed, the voice, and the volume of that screen reader, which is great. So they really vastly improved that with the operating system. Another aspect that I really am excited to see for the future for PlayStation is something called game presets. And it's something you can be able to adjust where essentially you'll set things in a game by default. Right now, it only works with PlayStation 5 games exclusively, but it has the ability to be able to, you can set the default default difficulty setting. You can set the default to like subtitles to be turned on or off, the ability to be able to invert controls by default. And you can be like, when you go into a game and you have those game presets turned on, it'll automatically change those settings in the game for you. Like I said, it's not available at least at this time, in PlayStation 4 games, but hopefully if games are going to be optimized for the PlayStation 5, that is something that they will tap into. But I can confirm it does work for PlayStation 5 games. So that's something that I'm really excited about, at least on the system side. The DualSense has its kind of like ups and downs. The haptic feedback is great for blind players because it allows players to be immersed in the world. So you can really do feel like if you're walking on sand or you're walking on metal, that haptic feedback is really precise. I kind of equate it to similar to like the very subtle haptic feedback that's in the Switch, but just a little bit more refined in a controller, which is great. The adaptive triggers are okay, but can be difficult for people with motor disabilities. And there is the ability to be able to turn those off within the system settings, and they won't automatically be turned on in games themselves. But I can't really say that makes it an accessible feature, because essentially it's just turning off a feature just for the sake of accessibility. It's sure. A good controller, but it definitely has it's not the best when it comes to accessibility.
Yeah, and we noted something similar. I played Astrobot all the way through, and that game is essentially a very refined tech demo for the DualSense controller. Man, my hands after playing a relatively short platformer were very tired. And you know, I can only imagine someone with a motor disability. I said like the bow, like when you have to get to like the fulcrum point on the bow and pass that, you know, it becomes easier, but you hit that point where you really got to press down on it and it's resisting you like that. I can't imagine that feels good or is easy for someone with a motor disability.
Yeah, it was something that we were like in the disability community, we were afraid of when they announced it, in that we were worried that it would we would not be able to turn that function off, and B, whether or not it was going to be like it could be useful for people with disabilities. And we're kind of seeing more of, okay, you can turn it off, but in reality, it even with the triggers just kind of natively without it turned on, there is actually a little bit more resistance than on the DualShock 4. Now, this could be because of it's just a new hardware, so it hasn't really had like time to sort of like get worn in, so it may become easier for that in the future. But at least for right now, for me, I definitely do notice there's a little bit more resistance on the triggers than on the DualShock 4. Plus as well, it's like the controller is heavier than the DualShock 4, and it is a little bit larger, so even though the button layout is the same, it's still like you feel like you're kind of like having to stretch across the buttons a little bit more than you were used to in the DualShock 4. So there is that. And so that's why I was like, yeah, it's okay. And it definitely can benefit like obviously blind players and deaf and hard of hearing players for sure, because they can feel the haptic feedback as well. But beyond that, it's just there's a lot of holes for accessibility with that controller.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And so Is there anything else that you wanted to add specifically for PlayStation? Because I would love to hear your thoughts about Xbox.
Yeah, I think that kind of covers majority of like a PlayStation in and of itself. But Xbox, yeah, moving to Xbox, essentially, like what they did several things right with accessibility. And I'm not to say that Xbox is better than PlayStation when it comes to accessibility, but they do have a better first start. Let's just say, like, they're a little bit ahead in that race for accessibility because of the fact that they kind of kept the operating system relatively the same as compared to the Xbox One. So the same accessibility settings that was in the Xbox One is now in the Xbox Series X and S. I think they just refined it and tweaked it a little bit to adapt to the new hardware, which is great. But pretty much if you were used to using those settings on the Xbox One, you can very easily go to the Xbox Series X and it will work the exact same way, even including the accessories that you used to be able to use for Xbox. So the adaptive controller is fully compatible with
you love to see that.
Yeah, it's amazing that they were able to kind of keep that in there, which was really great to see. So all of the accessories for the adaptive controller will still work with the Xbox Series X and S. And I love the fact that you just turn it on. As long as you pair it, then it's good to go. And everything is just the same as it was before.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And the benefit as well, that not a lot of people are talking about, but I think this is kind of gives Xbox an edge over PlayStation, is in regards to Xbox Game Pass. Not only as well, like, because it has over 100 plus games, it's a subscription service, it's day and date with first party exclusives. So there is that, but there is actually a very interesting accessibility angle with it too. So a lot of times whenever we as disabled players have to play games or want to be able to purchase a game, we generally sort of go for the physical copies of games because a lot of times we still don't know whether or not there's going to be accessibility in a game when it launches.
Sure.
So we have to sort of decide, okay, this is a game I'm interested in, but I don't know if I can be able to play it. So we generally would buy it, play the game, and if within like the first hour or so, we'll know if we could be able to play it or not. And a lot of times, if we buy it digitally, the refund policies as of right now are probably very, very bad.
Yeah, I think if you download it to your system, then you've essentially closed the refund window.
Yes. Yeah. That's with PlayStation and Nintendo. And I love sort of pointing this out because like it just proves like as well, like Nintendo, good in Nintendo. In their FAQ, if you purchased a digital copy of a game by accident or you want to get a refund, they actually say in the FAQ, we do not offer refunds for digital purchases, and you should have looked at reviews and screenshots to determine whether or not this game was for you.
Oh,
and I'm like,
oh no.
And I'm like, you know, excuse me?
That's not so I think
that's not great.
You bring up a really good point because when we look at refund policies in general, obviously Steam's policy, and I think Epic now mirrors that policy, where you've got 2 weeks, 2 hours in the game in order to determine whether or not you want to hang on to it or refund it. And the refund is an automatic process. I've gone through the refund process with Sony before. You still have to go through chat and you've got to, I think, unless they've updated it, you've got to go through chat. And as we talked about, you've got to download it. On the physical side of things, there was a time, and you grew up in the 80s, so you might remember this, where you could return an open game.
Yep.
And it was, hey.
Even I remember that. That was something that you could do almost all the way through the 90s. I think until you got to like 1997, where PC games especially were starting to be cracked and burned.
Yeah.
So once we got to like the cracking and burning stage of PC gaming, that's really what broke the whole you can still return an opened game. So
yeah, and cartridges you couldn't easily copy, you know, once you hit disc-based console games and there were mod chips
you could and you couldn't, and I'm not going into any of that on this
podcast. You could, but it was it was a lot it once CD burners became more affordable,
yes,
you know, yes, you had the instance of the accessibility of piracy became higher.
Wow.
That's true. And so like, and that was the thing too, is like, so even with, that's why we kind of, as disabled players, we generally will purchase it physically, because we can still at least trade in the game and at least get some of our money back. We probably wouldn't be able to get all of it, but at least we can be able to get a sum of it. And that's something we've kind of always kind of dealt with. And it was interesting that essentially, like, even with the new console, since I used to kind of say that for the PlayStation side, the difference in price between the digital version of the PlayStation 5 and the disc version essentially is a disability tax, because there was always that. And you're right, PlayStation does, like, it's still a process to have to go through, and there's no guarantee you'll be able to get a refund.
Yep, even depends if on who you talk
accessibility.
To.
Exactly.
Now, I think it's important, and I really want to put a fine point on this, that the return policies, we often think of them as, you know, just generally consumer friendly versus consumer unfriendly, but these are in some ways, looking at it through this lens, discriminatory practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's kind of even from a corporate side, I can see why that is they sort of don't list or mention it by, like, if you're disabled and you need a refund, we can still offer it to you. Cause I think that, like, even that's like discriminatory and not the sort of the best way to go. So that's why I don't think that they'll guarantee that they'll be able to give a refund. But I will say that Xbox is probably the more lenient of the three, because at least at this point you still have to be able to send a support ticket in order to be able to get a refund. But at least that way it's still kind of, you can be able to claim that it's accessibility. And again, there's no guarantee that you'll get it back, but at least they review that on a case by case basis instead of just sort of being an automatic thing. So until essentially refund policies change for digital purchases, that's why a lot of disabled players will buy physical copies of games. But bringing back to Game Pass, what's great about Game Pass is that if there is a game that launches day and date, Xbox exclusive, and you can download it, and you can play it, and if it doesn't work for you, you can delete it and try a new one. And there's no real money lost, because essentially all you need to do is just play at least 3 games a year, and you've pretty much paid for that entire service just for the subscription alone. You'll basically pay the equivalent of like 3 games. So mm-hmm. in that sense, this is great for accessibility, because it takes away the financial burden of disability, and it allows us to be able to try more games that we haven't been able to before. Now, granted, yes, it's still up to developers to be able to add accessibility into their games to be able to make Game Pass truly an accessible experience across the board. Mm-hmm. But at least we're getting to a point now that internally within Microsoft, they have teams in place that are actually actively making sure that accessibility happens in their studios. They have a team that's called Gaming for Everyone, and they're basically champions within Microsoft and within Xbox that are actively talking to studios and doing accessibility sprints and developer sprints to try to add in more accessibility. They have an outside sort of panel of accessibility subject matter experts that they can tap into. And they have direct access to each of Xbox's first party studios. And they're trying to be able to make sure that accessibility happens across the board. Now, it's still up to the studios to want to be able to implement it and how much they want to of accessibility they want to add. But across the board, at least there is a consensus of accessibility matters, and we need to try to be able to make it as happen as best as possible. And just that alone, I think Microsoft kind of wins has the edge over PlayStation for accessibility, because right now, we don't, unless there's sort of I think we all know that Sony's pretty secretive. We kind of seen that actually with even just the launch of the PlayStation 5, the fact that we didn't really know anything about it until weeks before it launches. We don't know if there actually is an active team in there. Sure, The Last of Us is definitely a huge, huge push for accessibility. But that was kind of more from a Naughty Dog side with the support from Sony than necessarily a Sony initiative telling Naughty Dog, you need to make this game accessible.
Right. Yeah. Got it.
And I think that's a great segue, because I want to talk about the studios and publishers that are doing this right. Can you talk a little bit about what set Naughty Dog and The Last of Us Part 2 apart from the rest of the pack when it came to accessibility settings. And then let's go from there and talk about whoever else is doing a really good job.
Sure. Yeah. So for Naughty Dog, their journey actually started in the development of Uncharted 4. They had there was a friend of mine who works there actually, or used to work there. They were approached by a disabled player. His name was Josh Straub, and he said, "I love the Uncharted series, and I want to be able to play the new game, but I can't because of my disability." And so that was the first time they kind of like really had any contact with sort of the disability community. So they tried to be able to see what they can be able to do. And Uncharted 4, actually, when it launched, was one of the few first titles that actually had an accessibility menu at the beginning of the game before the game even started, which was great. And there was several things that they were trying to be able to do. They couldn't do everything as they wanted to, but at least it was a start. In that area. And then when they were looking into developing The Last of Us 2, they wanted to kind of take that and move it a little bit further. There was a few sort of higher end executives at Naughty Dog that was like, we want to be able to try to make accessibility like happen in The Last of Us 2. And I've heard conversations like that Neil Druckmann had with those people and said, okay, I'll give you the time that you need. But be prepared, like if this gets a little bit too large, we may or may not be able to continue forward with it. But they were very passionate about it, and they were able to recruit a lot of champions internally within the community, where to got to a point where we can be able to make something happen in this. And and Nia was like, all right, let's do it. And so within the course of a few years, they were able to not only have all of the developers with, like, I think they said, like, there's not one developer at Naughty Dog that didn't touch accessibility in some form or fashion. And they did it right where they started from the beginning. They brought in consultants like myself. There's about eight consultants total across the industry, from blindness to deaf and hard of hearing to motor disabilities. And we were all brought in to kind of provide feedback on the game and what the progress they were making. And they kept going throughout it. And even when I got to see it in sort of its development stage before the game came out, they already had a lot there. And this was a few years already into the process. So they had already created a lot. And when the game launched, it had over 60 plus accessibility options. That is unheard of in the industry. At most, we get maybe 10, maybe 25, if it's a good game, the amount of settings there are for accessibility. But the fact that there are over 60, that is huge. That basically kind of sets The Last of Us so far ahead in the industry that it's going to take a lot of time for studios to be able to match and exceed what The Last of Us is sort of that standard that they had set. But there are definitely studios that have been doing it still for quite a few years and are still pushing towards that. Ubisoft is probably the best example of that. Mm. They started looking into accessibility several years ago, to the point where pretty much they were trying to be able to make at least every single game release that they had by 2020 to have at least a large suite of accessibility options. Didn't mean that they wanted to be able to make their game 100% accessible, because that'll be difficult in and of itself. But they wanted to be able to make sure that it was a cohesive, accessible experience across the board in multiple different franchises. So, and that's what I love about what Ubisoft has done, is that if you look into the accessibility options that are available in each game that has come out over the past few years, there is not only a cohesiveness of the similar settings, but there also is a improvement upon each game in Ubisoft's catalog. And this isn't just franchise only. Some of the settings that were in Assassin's Creed were in The Division. And some of the things that were in The Division moved over to Far Cry and moved over to Hyper Escape. So they're utilizing and sharing those resources across different projects. And they're making sure that there's a marketable improvement over each one. So let's say like the Assassin's Creed Valhalla as an example. is probably the most accessible Assassin's Creed we've ever had. And because when you put it in comparison, the very first Assassin's Creed that was released in, I think, 2013 had no subtitles. Like, that's how far back. Yeah.
So Origin, wow. You're talking about?
No. I'm talking Assassin's Creed, the first game.
Oh, so yeah. So we're talking 2000.
I think it was 13.
Oh no, it was Xbox 360. So it would have been 2000. Hold on, I'm gonna look it up. It came out. It was originally supposed to be an Xbox 360 launch game, and then it was delayed and eventually released in
November of 2007.
Oh, 2007. Okay, good.
There it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, the very first Assassin's Creed didn't even have subtitles.
That's wild. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it wasn't until the second one that's when they actually added it in. But it was essentially like that's how long it like that. But like when you kind of add it into the context of like, oh, wow, they actually did a marketable improvement for accessibility just in that short period of time. So it's just Ubisoft in general. Like if you look at it from a game to game standpoint, that's what I love to see, and I love seeing what Ubisoft is like tries to do each time, because there's always something new and there's always an improvement over the previous games that I'm just like, it's so cool to see. And they're basically, disability is a spectrum. Like there's many different sort of types of disabilities, and it's never just an on-off switch. There's like, I talked to a friend that's like has low vision, and we both have like a different sort of visions, even though we may have the same condition. But what's great is that what they are doing is they're filling in that spectrum more and more with each game they come out with.
And one of the things that we noted, because Ubisoft was kind enough to send us codes for their three big fall releases, they have consistently been moving the accessibility menu to the front of the experience.
Yeah.
So you've got your basic settings, like do you want performance or fidelity? Do you, you know, tune your HDR, all that stuff. And then the very next menu is the suite of accessibility features. Mm-hmm. So they're not burying them, which I think is a huge improvement, as you mentioned earlier. And it's one of the things that we noted. I think we're starting to see, options menus being moved to the front of the experience, but it is not universal that we're seeing accessibility options moved right up.
Yeah. And Ubisoft is very good at that. Now, full disclosure, I am listed in the credits for Watch Dogs Legion and Assassin's Creed Valhalla. So that is something
that's really cool though.
Yeah. Oh man, it's been a crazy year for me. I didn't think that three of the games I worked on essentially would be released. And definitely, and that's something that was brought up a many times from different accessibility consultants, not even just myself, is that a lot of times whenever a game just sort of starts and you're supposed to kind of go through this like tutorial before you can even get access to the main menu, it is difficult for disabled players to be able to even jump into a game like that, because there's nothing for them to be able to adjust the settings to match or remove some barriers for their disability. So I love the fact that basically it's going to be a guarantee that any Ubisoft game from here on out is going to have an accessibility menu at the beginning before you even start, which is something that I'm very excited to see. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really great. That was one of the things, like when I sat down to set up both Valhalla and Watch Dogs Legion, that was the thing that really grabbed me to begin with, because it's just something that I haven't seen very often, especially on the AAA side. I've seen it in indie games. Like, indie games care a lot about accessibility with their limited budgets, but they will be more likely to put it up front. But seeing Ubisoft do it was just like life affirming.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So my question here is, we talk about Ubisoft, we talk about indies. Amanda, that's a really good point. Are there tool sets? Are there best practices guides? Are there things that developers can tap into if they don't know where to start? If they don't know what questions they should be asking or what features they should be considering, what are the best resources available for them so that they can educate themselves and perhaps take advantage of learnings from other developers who have successfully implemented accessibility features?
So there actually are two amazing resources that you can be able to go to, and they're completely free. They're basically websites that you can be able to go to, and they have stuff from basic, intermediate to advanced, basic guidelines for when you're looking into working on accessibility. And then there's also a paid version that's actually run by Able Gamers. There is like they have these kind of like little like APX kind of cards, essentially like kind of like trading cards, where they have like different sort of accessibility like ideas and tools and tips essentially on them that you can sort of just keep and kind of reference at any given point. But the two free ones essentially is one that's run by or was created by Ian Hamilton, who's been in, I'd say probably been one of the few people that's been in this the longest for accessibility. He created this website called gameaccessibilityguidelines.com. And that's where I said, like, you can see sort of basic, intermediate, and advanced for multiple different disabilities. So at least you can kind of get a base start there. And then there's also Microsoft has their the same internal accessibility guidelines that they use for, or that they have for their internal studios. They actually have that freely available to the public. So if you search for Microsoft or Xbox accessibility guidelines through Google, you can be able to find it. And that'll kind of go through a similar sort of thing where you can be able to see what guidelines and strategies and tips on how to at least be able to get you started. And then there's, if you want to kind of a little bit more advanced, I usually would recommend checking out some of the talks that have been done at the Game Accessibility Conference over the past few years. We kind of nickname it GA Conf. And it's something that usually used to run around GDC. And it's where pretty much accessibility experts from across the industry and people, developers as well, come in and basically give talks specifically about accessibility. And there are a lot of developers actually that are actively there. Like, that's how I was recruited for Naughty Dog and for Ubisoft. And that's how a lot of my friends in the who were consultants basically got their sort of start or consultancy work, because of developers are just there to actively try to be able to find ways to make accessibility happen. So if you're able to attend that conference as well, that's even better, because then you have direct access to a lot of amazing experts, because we pretty much all of us within the industry, like we're pretty much always there at that one. That's kind of like our E3 in a sense, or GDC essentially. So you're gonna find a lot of the same people that are working in the industry, whether it's they're working in studios or consultancy full time. So it's like those would probably be the best resources to be able to find ways to be able to at least get started in accessibility.
Excellent. The other piece of that, you know, that's talking about the development of specific features, and obviously, my question was about features. There's one other piece of that, which is general work process, not just how do we make our games more accessible, but how does, instead of having to actively think about that, as I think we're starting to see developers move from not thinking about it to actively thinking about it, What do you think is necessary in order for that to just be an ingrained piece of the process? Is there anything more than, hey, we've been, you know, it's just, we actively thought about it for a while and now it's just part of the process? Or are there active steps that need to be taken in order to just bake it into the studio culture?
Essentially, it would mean having to be able to bake it into the studio culture, because when that happens, that means that more people are on board, and oftentimes, at least features that would have been created for accessibility, were less likely to get cut. There's many times I've heard where even with a small team of people who are accessibility champions, whenever they get to the point where they have to crunch to be able to finish a game, and they have to sort of decide, okay, what features are in, what features are out. I've heard many times from different studios that usually accessibility is the first to go, just because of just the amount of resources that needs to be dedicated to it. And not to say that accessibility features take more resources than any other feature. It's a lot more difficult the further along the development process you get to be able to add that in and integrate that, because it just means you can't be able to change things and edit things or fix things or add new things as you go. We like to say that accessibility has to start from the beginning of the design process, because when you want to build, like when you're thinking about creating a game, even from a gameplay setting where I don't want to get into the full this conversation, but for Demon Souls or Souls type games where difficulty is generally main part of that gameplay, when you're thinking about creating something like a gameplay loop like that, you're generally like you're thinking about sort of a one type of player that is able to utilize their full function of their hands, their eyes, their ears, whichever. And they're able to full like with a little bit of practice and a little bit of skill, they can be able to accomplish the goal that you set out for that player. What accessibility from accessibility, if you start from the very beginning, what that does is that sort of takes away that, okay, there's one type of player that can be able to do this. And it means that more players are able to do this. That's where accessibility can really shine, is that when you design it from, okay, there's going to be multiple different types of people that are going to want to be able to play this, whether they, let's see if we can be able to try to be able to make this available for everyone to be able to jump in. And whether that's adding accessibility settings and options to be able to adjust that gameplay, or having it baked into the gameplay, or something that's adaptive accessibility that adapts as you play, that something like that, that essentially it's better integrated when you start with that process. It is a lot very difficult to be able to add that later on. I use the examples of text size. Before, when you have like The Witcher 3 and God of War, they were released with, and actually even Outer Worlds, they released with very small text. And with God of War and Witcher, they did release a patch that increased the font size, but it wasn't enough, because essentially if they increased it even more, it would break the entire UI of the game. And so it basically did really nothing when they released that patch. But what I liked, at least what Outer Worlds did, that's kind of their only example that I've seen that actually has worked, is that it, like, the developer who really took on at Obsidian to be able to try to be able to increase the font size, it was something that he did after launch. He was able to actually integrate it like within an afternoon. He was able to add in the ability to be able to increase the font size throughout the entire game within an afternoon. But what it took was, it took 3 months for him to be able to fix the UI bugs that it caused. And thankfully Obsidian was able to like see the potential of that, and they were able to give him the resources to be able to work on it, and they eventually released it as a patch so that you can be able to go in and adjust the font size of the Outer Worlds. It's the only game I've ever seen be able to do that post launch. And actually there are several games that actually been able to sort of add accessibility settings post launch, but usually it's because they've had it started, or at least they had it, but it wasn't completely finished by launch period. So, but what we always recommend is still, if you do it from the very beginning, then at least that way, when you do launch, there is already something there and you can just basically improve on it or add extra settings in a post launch sort of scenario.
I wonder if this is something that Epic and Unity and any of the internal engine teams need to be looking at as baked in functionality to those engines, as opposed to pushing it down the line towards the developers to implement it individually in their games.
We're still seeing that essentially developers are still using very old engines and they're just trying to be able to squeeze in as much power and capabilities as possible in those engines. So right now, actually, that is something that we'll definitely need to improve in the industry, is sort of creating engines that have accessibility options kind of built in, or at least the ability to plug in accessibility tools that are created from the development community or within the studios themselves, to try to add it in and have it baked in from that. And until we get to that point, I think, I don't know what other engines are currently being worked on, but I think from what I've heard, Unreal 5 is currently being worked on with the ability to be able to at least add accessibility in, or at least having accessibility options in that new engine. So until studios can be able to kind of get past like, or use a different engine or a newer engine that has that built in, it's going to take a long while for studios to be able to try to integrate that easily, or at least faster than or more efficiently than previously.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I mean, from a development perspective, if you are just trying to shoehorn in things that the engine was not necessarily built for, then I would imagine that that's just an uphill battle all the way.
Yeah, exactly. And one example I give, even in The Last of Us, so they developed their own, like Naughty Dog developed their own engine, but because it was an engine that was developed over several years, including into the Uncharted series, so the text to speech in the game, where essentially it, or the menu narration, it reads every single piece of text that is in the game itself. And what they tried to add an API that'll just read and narrate the text that pops up in a game. But they found that it just couldn't work with their engine. So what they had to do was when they had to record every single line of text in a using a text-to-speech voice, and it basically insert those as audio files and had triggers essentially for them to build for those audio files to play anytime that there's text that appears on screen. Mm. And I didn't know this even when I was, I didn't even realize this when they tested it. Cause I remember I kept saying, oh, well, the timing of this is a little bit slow when going from one section of the text to another. And I didn't realize until later on when they said, oh yeah, it's because we're having to it's not like an API that's reading it. It's like, it's actual like audio files that are triggered every single time. And I was like, oh, and so I looked it up and they even said that there's 128 megabytes worth of audio files just for the text to speech alone in one language. And there's 24 languages that they had to be able to create this for. Now you're not downloading you're not downloading 3 gigabytes of audio files just for text to speech and every single time you play the game. So it is localized in that sense. But that's just one example of how they had to shoehorn the engine to be able to work and to try to be able to get it so that at least menu narration was available across the board.
Man, that's just thinking back to my days as a software developer and working with a lot of voice input and output, that just gives me nightmares. scenario, man.
I can imagine.
All right, so let's pull back a little bit and look at the industry from a bit more of a broad perspective. Just like we like to look back to look forward with our guests, I want to look back to look forward about accessibility and how accessibility has really changed and evolved for the better in the industry. Mm. And where we still need to shore things up and you know, kind of do some forward looking as a result of looking backward.
Yeah, that's a great question. I will say that essentially this year, 2020, has been probably the biggest year for accessibility in general, just in regards to accessibility awareness. Accessibility has kind of been something that had been talked about in studios and a little bit publicly, over the past few years, the adaptive controller kind of was that first sort of big kind of awareness push for the disability community. And the fact that they Microsoft in, I think it was 2019, they released that commercial in the Super Bowl for the adaptive controller, which was really, really cool to see. And so at least that kind of started the awareness campaign for accessibility. And for years, consultants and myself, we've been talking to studios. So studios were kind of a little bit aware of what accessibility was. But they couldn't really sort of know, what was it they kept asking, what's a good example of accessibility? And we would mention some games here and there, some indies, some AAAs, but they never really, it never was a full picture, until essentially The Last of Us. That we're going to be looking at The Last of Us as sort of as a touchstone moment for accessibility, because we'll be thinking about accessibility before The Last of Us and accessibility after The Last of Us. Now, granted, I did sort of become a part of that accessibility awareness when a video I put out earlier this year of when I saw the accessibility settings of Last of Us for the first time. I put out a video of my reaction to it where I got extremely emotional. And that which is so surreal to me that it got picked up by CNN, BBC, NPR,
anyone. It was so good, though. It was so good.
Thank you. I still it's just so surreal. It's that's the great. Okay, I'm famous on the internet for crying on it. But it's still, it was I definitely will say that it's that if for my little part, I was able to kind of make at least accessibility known that it's more than just settings and it's more than just options. There's humans attached to it, and I heard a few times where in certain studios, anytime a consultant will come in, that they'll sort of name internally the features that they're working on to some of the consultants, because it actually added a face and a person to the settings that they were creating for. So now we're at a point, I think a lot of people, a lot of the industry knows about accessibility, and now it's just sort of now that we know, what can we do to be able to make gaming as accessible to as many players as possible? And I think, like I said, Microsoft definitely has a head start in that. Sony is definitely has a very, very large initiative, at least internally from their studios, that they are very interested and want to be able to make sure that accessibility is part of their process. Like, even this year, Ghost of Tsushima and Miles Morales actually had some amazing accessibility options. It wasn't as robust or as large as The Last of Us, but there's some amazing features that are in there that unfortunately is not really talked about as much still. But I'm hoping that changes, that video games media will start to kind of cover that a little bit more. And when that happens, then we'll start to see a lot more push for accessibility. And so I'm really interested to see where accessibility can grow. I'd say if we had this conversation about 5 to 10 years, what I'm hoping is that every game that comes out will at least have some accessibility options that I can kind of nitpick and be like, well, if you did this and this and this, or you did this right, or did this really cool thing, instead of just reviewing games and being like, why don't you have some accessibility settings? Mm-hmm. So I think it's gonna be a while for the industry to be able to not necessarily catch up, but just be able to get to a point where they're like, okay, now we're starting to see the advancement for accessibility, and hopefully we'll get to a point where we'll have more games like The Last of Us for accessibility from a AAA and from an indie standpoint.
That makes sense. I mean, one of the things that I've written about, I've talked about a lot, especially over the last 3 years, has been, you know, the importance of diversity as a good business practice. Otherwise, you're leaving money on the table. We look at diversity. There are so many people out there, the very vocal minority, are like, just leave the games alone. They don't need anything. But a bigger audience, a broader perspective, makes games that much richer and that much more effective as vehicles of storytelling. So yeah, I actually would really like to see you nitpicking accessibility options in all of the games in 5 to 10 years. I think that would be really great. That's good content. I'm here. I'd like to subscribe.
That's what I'm hoping for. I mean, I'm ready. I'm ready for it to be able to get to that point, because it just means that there are going to be more games that are going to be available. And it does make it will make sales, like, even from the business side. Like, sure, like, okay, accessibility is a good thing to do, but it also can be able to make a studio money. I've heard countless times this year.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I've heard countless times this year of people like saying that they purchased PlayStation 4s so that they could be able to play The Last of Us, and because they've never been able to find a game that they've been able to play. So it does make money.
Warms your heart.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's something when we do our consulting, it is something that we look at as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dream for this is that this becomes a piece of the way people cover games in general. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, that's not going to negate the need for experts like you. But I think that the more that we talk about something, just as we've talked about other aspects of diversity and inclusion, and it's become a more common thing to see that across the board, I'd like this piece of that puzzle to be more of a mainstream topic of conversation.
Mm-hmm. And it's starting to happen. I've definitely seen a lot of conversations happening in the video games media about accessibility. Right now, it's still being like, they're still, because there's not a lot of people that kind of like know a lot about it. And they're sort of like, well, accessibility is a good thing. Yay for accessibility. I'm like, okay, that's great. But we need to sort of explain why this particular aspect of what you're talking about is a good thing, and what can be done to improve. And that's where I kind of feel like I can like fill that gap to a certain degree. And there are others definitely in the accessibility community that are able to do that. So I that's where I at least hope to see on the media side, is that there are subject matter experts at least can be able to kind of provide the context as to why accessibility is important and why this particular story that they're talking about is accessible, and what this does for the accessibility community, instead of just saying like, accessibility is great, let's do it, and that kind of thing.
I love the voice in that. That's just perfect. I didn't know I needed something so bad, but I needed that.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So just to kind of take this home, this has been a really, really positive conversation. And I want to give you the opportunity to speak directly. I mean, I know you speak directly to a number of publishers and first party console manufacturers. But to speak directly and broadly to them, if there is, you know, one thing or one set of things that you want from this generation, when it comes to making games more accessible, you know, what is it that you would like to see?
I would love to be able to see a more standard set of accessibility options. I always say that essentially every setting in a game is technically accessibility. It's not necessarily always options that are, like, there are definitely options that are designed for accessibility in mind, but pretty much every setting, anything you'd use to customize a game to be able to fit your play style is accessibility. But I would love to be able to see at least a standard set of options that are available, something like subtitles and the ability to be able to customize those subtitles, having larger text or the ability to be able to adjust the size of the HUD and the UI, full remappable, customizable controls, stuff like that. Like, I would love to be able to see, like, in pretty much standard throughout the game, so that the more options they add on top of that can eventually become standards for accessibility. I think that's kind of where I'm really excited to be able to see what PlayStation does with its game presets. The fact you can be able to set those settings as defaults, that's where I want to see that improve. I want to be able to, like, see a couple years down the line where that game presets menu is just like a long list of accessibility options that essentially just can be turned on automatically, so that when you launch a game for the first time, instead of just having to go in and manually change every single setting to be able to fit their needs, you just start the game and you don't have to worry about it. It's just automatically there. And as well, I would say I would love to be able to see more hardware options. Right now, the adaptive controller is pretty much the only, like, controller that you can be able to, like, easily get access to. Sony doesn't have a hardware solution. Nintendo doesn't really have a hardware solution. So I would love to be able to see those two essentially kind of push that forward, or at least have the ability to be able to have a universal adaptive controller that can be used across all three companies. That'd be great. But for right now, I would stick with those two. I would love to be able to see moving forward is definitely a standard of accessibility options and a lot more hardware capabilities.
That's fantastic. I absolutely love it. This conversation has been everything I hoped for and much more. Absolutely.
Thank you.
You should come back. We would love to have you come back and chat with us about accessibility basically all the time.
Hell yeah. I'm down anytime.
Or just about video games, really.
Oh, like, I'm always down to talk about video games too, for sure.
And you and I are going to start a Canada Stan cast. That's how this
works.
Where we just talk about being awkward Canadians. And
yep. New dude about it, eh?
I love it. Oh, God. I miss Canada so much. Oh, anyway.
Come back. We miss you.
I know. I really, listen, I have not been home in 3.5 years. Oh. And it's been pretty heartbreaking. I really need to get back to Vancouver. I noticed a friend of mine had moved there, and I'm like, I gotta go home.
Not gonna lie, I think I saw that same person. I'm like, ooh, I just want to go to Vancouver and be like, hey, hello, friend.
Hello, hello to all my friends. Everybody knows. But we don't wanna give our friend a shout out without their permission.
Yeah.
So this has been a really amazing podcast episode. This is what, like, episode, is this 60?
So yeah, this will go live. Yes, today.
Yeah, this is 60.
And then we have a new show to record, and it's another doubleheader weekend.
It is another doubleheader weekend. It's going to be very exciting. So anyway, this has been episode 60. Thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconcast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH. I did it.
You did it.
I did it.
You got it.
I did. Steve, where can people find you online?
You can be able to find me at Steve Saylor, SAYLOR on Twitter, or my YouTube channel, youtube.com/snowball, or the work that we do at, I know we didn't really touch a little bit on it, but Can I Play That? .com is a site dedicated to reviewing video games from an accessibility perspective. I'm the media editor there, but it's, check out those places where you can be able to find me.
Awesome. And you should absolutely do that, listeners.
Do it.
Because Can I Play That's fantastic.
Yeah. Very true.
And if this is your first time here at Virtual Economy, welcome. We are so delighted that you're here. If you would like more Virtual Economy, where we talk about the business of games for the rest of us, you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. There's one more. What is it?
Pocket Sand.
Please subscribe. And if possible, on your platform of choice, review the show. We do love to know what you think, especially if it's nice.
Especially if it's nice. I like love letters. I like love letters in my DMs. I'm not going to lie to you. So speaking of DMs, you can DM us with questions. And that's, again, at Virtual Econcast. And you can send us questions to podcast@fsquared.biz. If you have sensitive information and you're like, check it out, this is probably not super cool to talk about on Twitter. Mike and I both have Signal, like real journalists have Signal. That's us. We're real journalists. Tell my mother. Just kidding. I think my dad listens to this podcast, so they already know.
So it's not Chris, a secret. Tell Yvonne.
Tell mom.
See,
I'm
mom, I told you.
See, mom, I did it.
It's a real job.
It's a real job. I talk about video games and business. Anyway, so you can hit us up for our Signal, and we can have chats like that. So we will be back tomorrow with our news episode, which will be episode 61. We have a lot to discuss.
We do. It was originally not a huge... Man, and there was something that happened during this show needs to get added, and it's like, oh, no.
I wonder what that was.
Huh. Yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah.
It's a shocking thing that happened.
Yes.
So anyway, we will be back tomorrow. So in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you soon.